made her several years older than she believed herself to be, and I really got the lickens for that. But this is true. They are trying now to get men of a slightly younger generation into the leadership. But the truth is that most of the Chinese leaders today are in their 70s, and the men that they're going to are just a little younger, in their upper 60s. It's a whole shift in attitude toward age, which they worry about to some extent. They don't worry about having the older people in these positions, but they worry about not having younger people being brought up fast mm-hmm. enough. They worry about the fact that so many of the younger people have to wait and wait and wait and wait before they can advance, because there isn't any change in that sort of middle area. And they're trying to do something about it. Premier Zhou Enlai, who is a remarkably brilliant man, and I'm very proud to have had a chance of knowing him over many years, this was one of the problems that he was most concerned about, doing something to break this logjam, because it isn't, after all, a good thing for a country to be ruled only by men in their 80s or their upper 70s. They may have something to contribute. They probably do have great wisdom and experience, but you need a mixture of all ages. And I just as I would be terribly concerned of a government which is composed only of young men. I think that they might have great energy and skill and imagination, but they would lack the memory, you see. And so that one extreme or the other, or either one, I think is bad. You want a middle course.
I want you to explain something you wrote in this book, Without Fear or Favor, which is mainly about the New York Times.
Yes.
In the very first paragraph, in what really is the introduction, you wrote, "Our country has been passing through an epoch of change which begins to rival those surrealist dramas of Russia in 1917 and China in 1949, the communist upheavals in that country."
Yes. Yes.
Are we really going through that, do you think?
Yes,
you
I, say think it's so. The signs I think so. I think so. And the interesting part about it is that we don't even notice that it's happening.
Right.
This is our society is the premier society of change. This has always been true of America, and the great travelers who came here during the 19th century were constantly amazed at the way the face of the country between a visit of 2 or 3 years would change, and the way of doing things. They admired it enormously, and the whole world does admire this country for its ability to find new ways of doing things. And to take a very trivial example, New York City, which is always in the process of being rebuilt, and we sometimes think that today it's the first time it's happened that all of a sudden all the buildings along Third Avenue are replaced with glass houses, or the same thing happens on Park Avenue. I happened to find a postcard one day which my uncle had sent back to Minneapolis, which is my hometown, and his first visit to New York in 1911. There was a picture of Times Square, and he wrote back to his sister saying, "You better hurry and come and see New York, because it's being torn down." Well, it was being torn down then. It's been torn down a dozen times since, and lots of things are lost, but we gain a lot of things there. Now, that is a pace of really of revolutionary change in the physical context of an American city. In our society, beginning with the 60s, we proceeded to do all kinds of things which we sort of took for granted. We began to, just to take the field of religion, for example, we began to re-examine all kinds of basic presumptions which had gone unchallenged for centuries, let's say in the Catholic Church, and it wasn't confined to the United States, but perhaps some of the effects of it were most striking here. The Mass suddenly being given in the vernacular instead of in Latin, and priests and nuns suddenly doffing their black garb and appearing in ordinary civilian clothes and sports clothes, and you couldn't tell one of them from anybody else. Now, when you stop to think about it, those are symbolic changes of great significance, because centuries and centuries of tradition have just been brushed off in that manner. And if you take, for example, another thing that we had, the revolution in the universities, most people have almost forgotten the revolution in the universities, but it brought in the students and even the faculty into a new role of participation in decisions, whereas American universities, like European universities, traditionally had been very authoritarian. The president, perhaps with the aid of a small board of trustees, really ran things. All of a sudden, they began to be participatory, and and or many different attitudes changed. Take such a fundamental thing as how young men and women live. Segregated in barracks, we call them dormitories, totally barricaded from each other, as it was when I was growing up and many generations after myself, or today, when they all live together. And no one really thinks anything about it. Well, good heavens, when you think about revolutions in the way people live, this is about as fundamental a one as you can get.
Have you gone through a political revolution as well?
A political revolution we have gone through, too, in another way which most people haven't perceived. They may perhaps associate it with things which merely, I think, are symptoms of it. You take the civil rights movement, which we often call a revolt, beginning in the South, which all of a sudden, through popular movement, the movement of young people, black and or white, and then older people too, changed the basis of relations, really, between blacks and whites in this country and in our institutions. To be sure, there are many things that haven't changed, but this in itself, in any other country, a change of that magnitude, people would be wondering at it. They would be coming from all over the world to see how it happened and so forth and so on. In this country, it happened sort of by osmosis. Nobody planned it that way. You say, well, the Supreme Court decision, Brown versus the Board of Education, yes, that set it off, but that didn't start sit-ins in Woolworth stores and drug counters by young people in the South, and it did change the face of America in a most remarkable fashion. Then you can take something else which I think is without any precedent in American history, and this is what happened surrounding the Vietnam War. Here is an enormous military engagement, we get into with the full support of Congress and the full support of the American people. There were certainly some fringes against it, but basically, in those early days, the president and the Congress and the people were all together. We were gung-ho in this, as we had been in many things. And then somewhere in the process of that, not by anyone doing it, not by any party, political party doing it, but simply by grassroots movements of the people, it began to turn around. And it eventually turned it around, and we got out of that war. I don't know of any country in the world where such a phenomenon has happened. We sort of shake our heads and say, well, yes, you know, but we don't take the significance of that in, and I think it's a remarkable thing. You take it in the field of environment. It's 20 years since Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring, which many people take as the beginning of the environmental movement. Rachel Carson, what was she? She was a writer for a magazine. But what she wrote about the danger to the environment through the pollutants that nobody even had noticed them before, and the consequence that might follow from that changed the whole face of America, and not only America, but the whole world, because all of a sudden people begin to look around and say, oh yeah, sure, we are. Well, the river here, it's all full of chemicals. And we used to think that was wonderful. I remember when I was growing up, businesses, a manufacturing establishment, on their letterhead, they'd have a picture of that factory, and there'd be big smokestacks and smoke pouring out of those chimneys. And it showed progress. We were going ahead. We were building things. All of a sudden, people saw this. Oh, my God, we're poisoning ourselves to death. Well, this is the sort of thing that happened, and it hasn't changed the whole face of America, but it's given us a consciousness of what lies around us in terms that would have been inconceivable, I think, in other generations. There are a whole series of these things one could take. One could take consumerism, the sudden sort of revolt of the American against the big products of the big business that were going on. We have it in terms against big bureaucracy, big government. You take President Reagan, for example. I think that he represents this kind of a popular revolution against big government. Suddenly, where this had been the land of big everything. I remember Carl Sandburg writing a poem about Chicago, and it was a big town, and men with big shoulders did big things. And all of a sudden, we begin to say, gee, maybe big isn't the best thing. Maybe small is better. All these things happening and others that I could cite in a very short period of time in this country, and because we are so dedicated to change here, this is the way things are in this country. There's no other place in the world where things are like that. These revolutions that they are bragged up for Russia or China or something like that, they don't change the country nearly as much as what we do without hardly noticing it.
Let me ask you something else. You write, in again in this book, Without Fear or Favor, that the New York Times has become a fourth co-equal branch of the government.
Yes.
You strongly imply that a person who doesn't read the Times regularly is not very well informed.
Well, I think that's probably true. They may be well informed, but they're missing a very neat package.
Well, I agree with you. How did the Times get so powerful?
Well, not by intending to, and this is perhaps the key to many things in this country. Having been and worked as a correspondent for many years in communist societies and in the Soviet Union, where they always think things are done by plan. They're taking American institutions apart and trying to see how they plan to get to a certain place. I've many times been cross-examined by Soviet journalists and diplomats about how the Times plans to do this or the other thing. Well, knowing the Times, knowing what a chaotic institution it is, knowing that it's made up of so many diverse people, each one having a different idea, nobody knows really how the paper even comes out. There isn't any one person. I described that in the book. Nobody knows how it comes out. It really is laughable. But the truth of the matter is that it probably became great as an institution because of an effort to fulfill a vision of that newspaper, which was possessed by Adolf Ochs, the man who really founded the Contemporary Times back in 1896. He saw the Times as an instrument which would be of extraordinary use to people who needed to know about what was going on in the world. And he wasn't really thinking of a great popular audience. He was thinking of big businessmen, people engaged in enterprise and commerce, people in education, people in culture and arts, people in government, people interested in policy. And what he wanted to do was to present them with the information that they needed to know. If you were a banker, you needed to know what was the state of finances in Frankfurt, Germany, or in Tokyo, or in San Francisco, and he wanted to put that in his paper. If you were in the government, and you were interested in foreign affairs, you wanted to know what the foreign policy of England was, and what was happening in the Quai d'Orsay in France, or what the Kaiser was doing in Germany, and he put that in his paper. And he went through all these different things. He was a great believer in education, and he saw the newspaper as an educational tool and instrument. And today, the Times still is, in its contemporary dress, really the epitome of that basic concept.
What do you think? Look forward to the future a little bit and talk a little bit more about this revolution. What are the country's great unmet needs, do you think? And what directions do you think we'll go in the next decade or two?
Well, I think that our greatest needs lie in certain domestic fundamentals which have been neglected in what I would call an almost constant preoccupation with foreign affairs, foreign adventures in some cases, and foreign responsibilities which followed World War II and followed the evolution of the United States as a genuine world power. We have enormous resources, but perhaps we have been devoting too many of those resources to things which are basically unproductive, although sometimes necessary, and I'm thinking of military armaments and things, and great, enormous, costly ventures such as Vietnam. I believe that, and I'm not an economist, so I may be dead wrong about it, but I think that many of the economic problems we have in this country really stem back to that war and the enormous amount of money that was plunged into it. And so we have accumulated in this country a whole series of really pressing needs. And I would say that if I were to put them in some order of priority, I would say number one, probably education. And here I'm not thinking so much of the cuts in education which have been made in recent budgets. I'm thinking of the fundamentals of education and giving it a priority right straight across the country, since I regard an educated citizen as the most valuable asset any country can have. If you don't have educated citizens, all the rest of it just falls down because you don't have a viable democracy. Education is a fundamental rock on which the country is built. So that I think that we have an enormous budget in education which must be fulfilled. I would say that perhaps number two, and this is closely associated with it, is the economic situation that underlies the decay of cities. There's sort of an osmotic relationship between poverty and the decay of the cities. if people are poor, they can't pay enough taxes to support a fine city. Fine cities are really another building block of democracy. And we must in some way, and I don't know exactly what the means must be, we must find a way, and education is one of those things, of educating people so that they can earn a living and take an effective role in society, and at the same time live in a city which has the services that make it a decent place to live. Cities are not a modern invention. Men have lived in cities or accumulations of humanity from the earliest times, and they're almost an evidence of civilization. And while we are, it's possible now with our modern transportation and communications to spread out and live in suburbs, in other words, we're really just simply extending the area covered by a city, still it does have a context, a definite context. And if there's part of that body, which may be the urban core, but increasingly is now becoming the suburbs, which is sick economically and socially, then the whole body eventually becomes present. And what we really need is an enormous infusion, not just of money, but of imagination in working on this particular problem. And if I were to take a third problem, I would think I would say it probably lies in the overall field of social well-being and health. The United States is the only major Western country which does not have a basic government-supported medical program of some kind. We have bits and pieces of it, but we don't have the whole thing. And what we do have is terribly, terribly expensive. And I don't know the solution for that. I don't think we want to go to state medicine because somehow that is so gray and bureaucratic. Mm-hmm. It hasn't worked all that well in many other countries. I've seen state medicine in socialist and communist countries, and I don't want it. It's good, it's a safety net, let's say, if I can use that phrase, but it doesn't give you the best kind of medical care. On the other hand, our system clearly is upended economically so that we have extreme costs without as much benefit as we ought. It needs a total overhaul, and it needs imagination again.
Final couple of questions about Harrison Salisbury, the man. What's life been like for you after you retired almost 10 years ago from the New York Times?
Well, I
better,
tell you,
worse?
Well, it's been wonderful because I'm a very fortunate person. I retired from the New York Times, that's true, but I didn't retire from my work. My work has simply gone right on exactly in the same degree as it did before on the Times. But my writing has tended to be more in the field of books and in magazine articles than it has been in articles for the paper, though I haven't quit writing for the paper or writing reviews and things of that kind. What it's given me has been a time to, when I gave up my job at the Times, I had, I think, either 7 or 8 books under contract, which I hadn't had time to get to. I'm gradually working them on. What bothers me is that I keep adding new ones, so the backlog is still there. But it's great fun to do that, and I enjoy it, and I think that I don't happen to believe in retirement at all, except in the case of somebody who's doing something awful, like an assembly line, where he's getting absolutely nothing rewarding out of it. But if you're doing something that you like, I'd say if you possibly can, go on and do it. I mean,
you'd never retire to the creek with a fishing pole.
No, I loved fishing when I was a kid, and I still think that I would, but I don't ever seem to have time to do it.
We hope not. Thank you very much for being
My
with
pleasure.
Us.
My pleasure.